It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Women have made progress in the workplace. We have more female leaders in the business world than ever before.
But surveys of women in the workplace show the majority feel gender discrimination exists, and almost three-quarters of female professionals in Washington, D.C. say men have more opportunities than women do.
How can women deal with this gender bias? What should they do to fight assumptions about gender roles at work? Our next guest wrote a how-to book that offers advice for women in the workplace.
We're joined by Joan C. Williams and Rachel Dempsey, mother and daughter, also the authors of What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. Joan is an expert on work and family issues who's written extensively on gender bias. Rachel is a writer and a student at Yale University School of Law. Joan, thanks for being here.
Delighted to be here.
And Rachel, good to have you along, too.
It's great to be here.
Well, we're a long way out from the days when women were limited to a couple of so-called female professions. We've now got women surgeons, soldiers, pilots, just about anything you can think of. But the numbers of women who report gender bias at work is still pretty significant. Why are so many women still experiencing gender bias on the job, Joan?
There are a lot of studies that show that although explicit bias has really, really fallen, subtle or implicit bias really hasn't changed much at all. And so not all, but a lot of what we talk about is the kind of subtle biases that come out in everyday workplace interactions.
Now, Joan, you developed a speech, a sort of presentation about this as you identified four categories of gender bias on the job. Can you tell us about the response that women gave you?
Well, I developed a talk called The Four Patterns of Gender Bias. That was the first step, really, in my evolution on this. And I would describe them, and women immediately recognize them when you name these four patterns. But I realized that I had to stop giving that talk because I was just depressing them. And so what I did is went, and every time I met a savvy woman, I said, can I interview you? And what the book, What Works for Women at Work, shows is the strategies that women have used in order to successfully navigate through these patterns of bias.
And Rachel, you represent the next generation of women on the job. What do you think changed between your mother's generation and your own?
One of the women that we interviewed, I think, characterized this very well. She said what happened is the low-hanging fruit of gender bias has all been picked. So the explicit discrimination, the out loud comments about how men are better employees than women, are largely eliminated. And what remains is these biases that the research that Joan studied identified.
Now, you talk about the four areas that you've identified and that these are the areas that women need to be aware of, and you provide tools for working within them. But let's start by talking about them first. Can you run us through them quickly, Rachel?
Yes. So the first pattern of bias is called prove it again. And it is that women have to show more evidence of competence to be seen as competent as men. The second pattern is the tightrope, and it's that women have to walk a very fine line between being liked and being respected. And there's backlash if you veer too much towards either one of those characteristics. The third is maternal wall, and it's the bias that women experience when they become mothers, and it's actually documented bias that mothers are seen as less competent and committed even when their work performance is the same. And the fourth pattern is gender wars, and that's what happens when bias against women turns into conflict between women.
And Joan, of those four, which do you think is the most prevalent in the workplace?
Well, based on my interviews with the women I spoke to, the tightrope bias was the most prevalent. Three-quarters of the women I spoke to had encountered that kind of bias. So they felt they often had to choose between being liked but not respected or respected but not liked. So here's an example of the kind of liked but not respected sort of problem. Often women are expected to do a large load of what we call office housework. So that could be taking notes, answering the phone, planning parties, actually, is something that women are very often expected to do. And then there's substantive work that is important but very devalued. Committee work is a good example. And women are often expected to do far more of that. And so we provide strategies for women who find themselves with very heavy loads of office housework.
So we're not just talking about, you know, the 9-to-5 thing, Dabney Coleman saying, go make a pot of coffee or something like that. We're talking about things that are more subtle.
You know, so actually, sometimes it's amazing. I interviewed one woman at a very, very large company whose name you would recognize, and she was just two levels down from the CEO. And just the as a result of the interview, she decided to stop making cupcakes for everybody's birthday. So some of it's subtle, some of it's not very subtle, but obviously, in that kind of situation, what you say is, if it's your birthday, tell your supervisor your birthday, and then the supervisor's assistant will make sure there's a party for everybody. It's just a very concrete strategy that would help people. Or if you're constantly being asked to take notes, then take notes once, and then just say, perkily, you know, I think we should set up a rotation, and we'll take turns taking notes.
How do you feel, before we get into more of the practicalities of your advice, both of you I'd like to hear from, but we'll start with Rachel, but how do you feel about having to set up sort of this labyrinth course for women to cope with these things? Your advice ranges from, you know, little strategies from comebacks that you can use to have at your ready, to tone of voice, to body posture. Why does women still have to worry about this? Why can't they just show up at work and be themselves, Rachel?
Well, there's a very well-known and a great book on these issues called Through the Labyrinth. So you're not the first person who has noted that it's sort of a labyrinth that women have to go through in order to dodge a lot of the biases and the obstacles that are in their way. That said, I don't think that the book should be read as a labyrinth. It's more of a toolkit. So if you, in your experience, run into these problems, then there are solutions that are concrete and that you can find in the book. You don't need to follow. There's absolutely no way to follow all of the advice in the book. We don't recommend it. I would not do that. And the fact is that women have very, very different problems. And one good example of that is the tightrope. We divided problems in the tightrope into two masculine problems and two feminine problems. And obviously those are very sort of imprecise words for what's happening. But women who face backlash for being too aggressive and women who aren't taken seriously for not being aggressive enough. And we really tried to come up with patterns with solutions for both of those problems. And often women will have one problem or the other problem, but obviously you don't need to do both sets of solutions.
Right, so it's a toolkit, but what about the standing question, Joan, that in this day and age, women need to have such an extensive toolkit?
You know, I have worked for 20 years on changing organizations to make a level playing field for women, and organizations are changing, but they're not changing fast enough. There are still very few women CEOs, and there's still very few women on the top jobs. And sad to say, at a certain point, I just said, you know, instead of working only on organizational change, I'm going to give women a guidebook to help them navigate what's there now. Do I wish they needed it? No. But do they need it? Yes, they do. And since they do, I'm going to provide it for them.
Well, before we go to the news, let's talk a little bit about the first category, the prove it again gender bias that exists in workplace. And this essentially is saying that, you know, men can prove themselves once or, you know, whatever it takes, and then they're good. They've got the stamp of approval and they can go forward. Women find they have to keep proving themselves over and over again. Joan, what can they do when that happens?
Well, one thing they can do, if you think about it, women's mistakes tend to be noticed more and remembered longer, and their successes tend to be attributed to luck rather than skill. So if people are going to tend to remember your mistakes, you're going to have the objective facts to show them what your accomplishments are. So it's very important for everybody, but especially for women, to take careful real-time records and document all objective metrics that you've met. If you get a compliment, if it's by email, make sure you keep it. If it's not, say, I'm so delighted. Can you drop that in an email? I'm really going to treasure it. Because then when you're in a context where you're being evaluated, you have objective things to show people. Another important strategy we call the posse, which is that to have a group of people, actually we recommend men as well as women, and you celebrate each other's successes. So again, you're keeping your successes at the top of people's mind. The posse also is what I call gender judo. You're doing something very masculine, which is self-promoting, but you're doing it in a way that's expected of women, a feminine way. Because women, of course, are supposed to be modest and attuned to others. So the posse allows you to celebrate someone else's successes. What a selfless, good woman. Meanwhile, though, someone's celebrating yours.
So you're not just talking about going out for a drink to celebrate a good deal done after work. You're talking about actively talking each other up.
Absolutely. I was in my office one time and I received an email and it said, it was from Peter, and it said, Letty did a good thing. And then several months later, I received another email and it was from Letty and it was talking about the great thing that Peter did. That's the posse.
Well, we're talking to Joan Williams and Rachel Dempsey about their new book called What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know.
And we want to hear from you. Is this ringing a bell for you? Are you nodding along saying, yeah, that's what it's like where I work or where I used to work? Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you think gender discrimination, subtle or overt, is still a big problem in our workplaces? Why or why not? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue our conversation in a minute, and now a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Joan Williams and Rachel Dempsey right now. They're the authors of What Works for Women at Work. Their new book is about ways for women to combat gender bias on the job.
And do you have a question maybe about where you work now? Are you experiencing this kind of bias, or do you see it among other people at your workplace? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can share your questions, your experiences, maybe your own advice at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
Let's go to the calls right now, and we've got Vaishali joining us in Madison. Hi, Vaishali.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
Well, I'm thrilled that, first of all, you're doing this piece. I think it is timely and important because I agree with the earlier comment that the low-hanging fruit has already been picked, so I think that gives people the misinterpretation that perhaps this is not such a big issue anymore. I think it's huge, and it's just happening in more subtle ways. And I like the discussion about factors numbers 1 and 2, but I actually feel, from my perspective, and this has happened to me personally, I'm a professor at a major medical school, a highly ranked medical school in the country. And I can tell you that in my department, the problem is actually woman on woman. And it's not the men that are holding these biases. It's women who have chosen very different life paths for themselves versus those of us who have tried to balance having family with our careers. And it's, that's been at the core, I think, of, you know, because you're a woman who's made this choice, then you have to prove it again that you're still committed even after having kids.
So you're talking about, Vaishali, you're talking about tug of wars that happen in the office between women, or are you talking about stuff that takes place outside of the workplace?
I'm talking about within the workplace, not so much on a day-to-day interaction level, but when it comes to decisions about promotion and career advancement.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you for that. And Rachel, let's talk about that a bit, because that is something that comes up in your book, is something that is very important. And it seems as though, I guess, you know, as a woman, we think it should be natural to support and help and defend other women, but it doesn't always play out that way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is Vaishali, what you described is a typical example of the tug of war, and specifically of mommy wars. And I think that the decisions that you were talking about, and you characterized it well, it's choices about how you live your life. It's choices about whether or not you have kids. It's choices often tug of war will emerge around between women who have sort of two masculine problems and women who have two feminine problems. And these choices are all very, very personal choices, and they're all very, very sensitive choices. And these conflicts arise when people make different choices and end up getting judged for being the wrong kind of woman.
And if I can add one thing, I mean, the reason that the tug of war arises and it's so vivid in this arena is you think about it, almost every woman is trying to prove that she's a good worker and a good mom if she's a mother. And so that every woman feels, oh my gosh, maybe I'm not such a good mom. Maybe I'm not such a good worker. Or if you don't have kids, you're trying to prove that you actually are a full-grown woman with a full life without children. All of these women feel embattled. And they all feel embattled because they're all being judged because of these various gender assumptions. And that's what sets them and creates the conflict among them.
Well, what is some advice that you can give us, Joan, about how to deal with some of these things when they come up as mothers, maybe when a working mother feels that she is her commitment is seen as lacking or something else that typically comes up? What can a woman do?
I think the most important advice in tug of war is it's one of the patterns that is really important to recognize that it is the result of gender bias in the environment. It's not the result of an individual woman with a personality problem. And you really have to recognize the limits of sisterhood. After all, do men always support other men? They don't. But if you are having mommy wars problems in a workplace environment, it probably means that the mothers are really embattled. And it may mean that the women without children feel like they're getting huge loads of work dumped on them. The one study shows that women without children actually work the longest hours of unpaid overtime. And so I think it's really important for the women to realize that they're all struggling and that if they somehow can work together if they can work together, that they can maybe change the workplace.
We have an email here from Janet who says, I just started a new job. And my coworkers and myself have been referred to as girls each of the 4 days I've been there. This happened both at the work site and during orientation. I'm a 50-something-year-old professional. Why does this persist? Why do I have to address this at every workplace? Rachel, what would you say to Janet?
I would say to Janet, unfortunately, the patterns of gender bias that we've identified are very strong, and people have a hard time associating women with professional success, and that will lead to things like an infantilizing girls. As far as advice for her, I would recommend, one, the women can talk to each other and start referring to themselves pointedly as women or as whatever they want to be referred to. You can also, in that situation, find an ally if there's someone that, at the workplace that you think might be sympathetic to your argument. Talk to him and see if he can try to change the language.
And in our last couple of minutes here, I wondered if, Joan and Rachel, you could both take a turn giving a couple ideas for women to sort of own their power and to perform like powerful women who deserve respect and are ready to move up in the workplace. Joan, what would you tell someone?
Well, one thing that happens to women all the time is what we call the stolen idea, where a woman says something and it's overlooked, and a man says something and all of a sudden it's heard and it's really brilliant. So we represent provide a range of comebacks. You can have a sort of what we call a true moxie comeback. When it happens, you just say, is there an echo in here? Or when it happens to another woman, you can say, well, you know, when I heard Rachel say that, this was my take on it. Or when it happens to you, you can say, you know, that you've heard exactly what I was thinking, and then add a point to it so it's not so confrontative.
Okay, so those are some good ideas, and that's one that I think happens to a lot of people. It could be useful in a number of scenarios. Rachel, what do you suggest?
So I have two pieces of advice, and they're not entirely consistent. The first is this is sort of a concrete situation where often when there's a job opening or an opportunity for promotion, say there's 9 criteria that are required in the job posting, women will often wait until they have 10 of those things before they apply to a job. Men will do it with 6. So being conscious and putting yourself forward, even when you don't necessarily perfectly fit the job description, is a very important. And then on the second piece of advice I have is to be gentle with yourself and know that it's not always your fault. These biases are real. They have documented effects. And often you can be doing everything basically right and still run into problems.
And we have to leave it there. Sorry, but thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking to Joan Williams and Rachel Dempsey. They're the authors of What Works for Women at Work, 4 Patterns Working Women Need to Know. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we go behind the scenes in Wisconsin's sturgeon spearing season in today's edition of Curious Wisconsin. The season on Lake Winnebago opens this Saturday. We have an expert to explain how the tradition got started in Wisconsin.
Before we get to that, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism broke a story today about a new mining study that's going to be conducted in Wisconsin over the next 5 years.
Researchers will be looking at how former mining sites, especially things like sand mining sites, can be restored after the operations are closed down. Holly Dolliver joins us now. She's Associate Professor of Geology and Soil Science at UW River Falls. She's the lead scientist of this mine site reclamation project. Holly, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Good afternoon. It's great to be with you.
Well, let's start with the basics here. What is mine site reclamation?
Well, the idea is that after we go through and mine an area, one of the key things that we need to consider is how we're going to reclaim that landscape and how we're going to restore it back to vegetation and some kind of end-use function that we want to be able to get at.
Is this something we've done in the past as much maybe as we should have, or is this something that's really getting bigger in the last decade or two?
You know, the reclamation is something that's been going on for a very long time, and we've had mine sites in Wisconsin, and we've done reclamation. We've restored the landscape. I think the thing that's different now is that we're talking about mining on a much larger scale. Especially with the frac sand mines, we have large areas and we have rapid growth in mining. So there's a new resurgence and a need to better understand that reclamation process.
Paint us a picture of an unreclaimed mine site versus one that proper reclamation has been done on. What's the difference?
Well, I think, you know, in the unreclaimed mine site, those are usually the sites that are being actively mined. And you would probably see piles and sort of what we would call spoil piles, where you would have the rock, the overburden that they were not interested in. You would see that piled up. The material would look very, you know, not very uniform. You'd have piles of material. And then after they go through and do the reclamation process, they put the soil back down on the landscape. That's usually stockpiled prior to mining. So they actually go back in and relay down that soil, and they try to do it very carefully layer by layer. And then the final step in that process is usually reestablishing some vegetation back to the landscape.
You mentioned that your study will deal a lot with frac sand mine sites. This is the sand that gets used elsewhere in the country for fracking of natural gas and oil. Is reclamation different for metallic mining, like, say, an iron mine, versus non-metallic, like, say, frac sand?
Well, some of the reclamation concepts are very similar. The difference is oftentimes in the mining practices and in the scale of mining. So when we think about some of the metallic mines, we think about large holes in the ground and you're digging sort of below the ground surface. In the case of the frac sand mines, we're actually mining upland areas. So geologically, the setting is a little bit different. So we're mining these upland areas. We're changing sort of the nature of the land surface there. So when we go back in and do reclamation, we have to kind of think about those things, that the landscape sort of had a different function to begin with. And often in the upland areas, we have thin soils, and that's one of the major things that we'll have to consider with our frac sand reclamation.
seems like erosion might be a special problem that you'd have to deal with?
Yes. I mean, erosion is always a problem where you have steep landscapes, and a lot of these upland areas do have steep components to it. So erosion is going to be something that we're going to have to consider and something that we're going to have to look at when we do the reestablishment.
This is, as I gather, a 5-year study. How are you going to do it? How do you conduct a study like this?
Well, you know, the great thing about having 5 years is we get to really take a scientific look at the landscape over time. And one of our key things, we're going to start off our study this fall or this spring, and we really want to understand what soils and what the landscape is like prior to mining. And then we've got a mine that we're going to be working with, and they're just getting ready to reclaim a portion of an area that's already been mined out. So we'll actually be establishing some scientific instruments, going through that reclamation process, and then actually scientifically evaluating how does the vegetation reestablish? What species are successful? How are soil physical properties changed, or what's happening to soil physical properties or biological properties or chemical properties? These are all things that we're going to evaluate in our study.
And what other kinds of things do you hope to discover once you have that basic information? What do we learn from that that we can put into practice and reclaim this former mining land?
Well, I think that's the great thing of doing scientific research is that we do hope that it's going to inform decisions in the future. I think, you know, one of the great things about our data set that we'll have is we'll understand the pre and post condition. So we'll sort of be able to have some target goals and benchmarks that we're going to want to achieve in the reclamation process, and hopefully we'll be able to understand how quickly we might be able to get to those points. Another big thing will be what type of vegetation is appropriate for the reestablishment process. You know, because of erosion, we might need to think about things that reestablish quickly. And then as the soil sort of matures over time, focus on sort of looking at trees or grasses or even agriculture, how, you know, what things might be best suitable for those landscapes.
Will we have to wait 5 years to start putting things into practice, or do you think you'll learn things along the way that can inform mining locations as we go along?
I think we're going to be able to learn some things pretty quickly. I anticipate that after year one, we'll have some findings. We're also evaluating the soil component of it, how best to put that soil back down. We're looking at amendments to the soil that might help with that process. And I think we'll get some data about that pretty early on in the process. And hopefully as the 5 years goes on, we'll continue to refine our approach with types of amendments or types of procedures that we could use in reclamation to get the best end output when we're finished.
And now frac sand mining is controversial in parts of the state, and I imagine critics are maybe listening right now saying, okay, reclamation is all well and good, but is it ever really going to be what it was before the mine came along?
Well, I think that's one of the great things about our study is we will be looking at pre and post mining conditions. I don't have the answer to that until we start collecting data. But, you know, that is something that we're going to have to evaluate. And surely there are some long-term changes to the soil. And we hope that we'll be able to evaluate exactly what the magnitude of those changes are.
Do you think there's a sense of maybe missed opportunities in the past that we could have closer to restored natural lands if only we'd done these kind of studies years ago?
You know, and in fairness, there has been some studies on reclamation. There's been, you know, studies in the West. There's been a lot of, especially metallic mining that's happened in the Western U.S. I think the difference that we have here is we're in a different climate. It's a different type of mining that we're doing, and, you know, we're just at a point where we need to collect some data to better inform decisions.
Holly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That's Holly Dolliver. She's Associate Professor of Geology and Soil Science at UW River Falls. She's the lead scientist of this mine site reclamation project.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This Saturday, the sturgeon spearing season opens in Wisconsin.
The extreme cold we've been having has created the thickest ice on Lake Winnebago in years. The weather's also created clear waters, which will help spears to spot the sturgeon.
Where does the tradition of sturgeon spearing come from? Why is it such a big deal here in Wisconsin? We've got an expert here to give us the story behind sturgeon spearing.
Kathy Klein joins us now. She's an educational specialist at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute and the author of People of the Sturgeon, Wisconsin's Love Affair with an Ancient Fish. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Can you describe a sturgeon for us?
Oh, describe a sturgeon. Well, I think the first thing that people say when they see a sturgeon is that it just looks ancient or prehistoric. It's a very unique fish. It definitely stands out from the other fish that you'll see swimming around in the Great Lakes or in the Mississippi River or in Lake Winnebago.
So I'm assuming it's brown and large.
It's brown and large. As it gets older, it kind of turns a little more grayish in color. Sturgeon don't have any bones. They're not a modern fish. They've been around for over 150 million years.
Wow.
So they have like a notochord running through their body, much like a lamprey or an eel. And around their body for protection, they have five rows of kind of spiny cartilage called scutes. And when they're little, sturgeon, their scutes are very pointy for protection. But as they get older, the scutes kind of soften out. And I always like to think about it as, the sturgeon, when they're young, they need a lot of protection from predators, but as they get older, they don't need any protection because they don't have any predators. They're the biggest fish out there in the Great Lakes. They just need protection from us.
Well, let's take it to us now. Where does the tradition of sturgeon spearing come from here in the state?
Well, it goes back well before Europeans settled our state. It was the Native Americans who have always been spearing sturgeon. The earliest settlers, European settlers who came to Wisconsin, have all sorts of accounts of the Menominee Indians spearing sturgeon through the ice. It was one of the things that they often wrote about when they were taking notice of the Native Americans. So as soon as people moved into this area in the 1600s, they were seeing that Native Americans were very successful at spearing sturgeon through the ice, and so they took up the method themselves.
So it goes back, obviously, a long way. How did it get to be an ongoing tradition to present-day 2014?
Well, when I did research for People of the Sturgeon, I did a lot of looking through all of the old fish laws, basically, for the state. So going back to when there was a fisheries commission first formed in 1874 to start managing fish populations in the state. And the state, you know, people started realizing that fish populations were starting to be depleted because there were so many people fishing. So they started enacting laws to try and help protect fish, including sturgeon. And the laws were kind of all over the place, and they changed from year to year. And one year, spears were outlawed, and then another year, ice shanties were outlawed. But there was a pattern that I noticed, and the pattern was that certain parts of the state seemed to keep getting exemptions from these laws, and they were areas along the Mississippi River, in Green Bay, and around Lake Winnebago. And these were all areas that were some of the earliest settled places in Wisconsin. And I kind of started to put together that the Europeans who settled in these areas were so used to being able to go spearing for their fish and lots of fishing that they just kept pressuring the legislature to let them continue this tradition.
Well, take us out on the ice of Lake Winnebago. What is it like? What do we actually do when we're spearing a sturgeon?
Well, today is the first day that it's legal to start cutting into the ice, and so it's a lot of work to go sturgeon spearing. The first thing you have to do is tow your shanty out on the ice, and then you have to find the perfect spot, of course, that can take a while. but then you have to cut in your hole, and the hole can't be any more than 48 square feet. It's usually kind of door-sized, imagine that. So this year especially, it's going to be a lot of work to cut in a sturgeon spearing hole because the ice is several feet thick. So a chainsaw is usually used with an extra long attachment on it. So you have to cut your hole and then sink the ice chunk underneath the ice, put your shanty on top and kind of pile ice or snow around your shanty. And spearing shanties are different from just regular ice fishing shanties because they have to be pitch dark inside. When you go into a spearing shanty, the only light that you're going to see is coming from actually the sturgeon spearing hole. So it's light that's filtered through the ice and coming up from the water.
Wow, that sounds like it's quite a, I don't know, mystic ambiance, this dark little hole on the ice. But I have to ask you, why do people have to spear the sturgeon? Isn't it, you know, easier just to fish for them, good old-fashioned fishing?
Well, you know, they're pretty large fish. There are fish out there in the Winnebago system that are well over 200 pounds, and oh, those fish would be over 100 years old, too. Sturgeon are, they're very special fish, like I said. They can live to be a long, they can live for quite a long time. They don't start spawning until they're in their mid-20s, so they're fish that needs to be protected, too. But we were just talking about, sorry, I just kind of got off off subject there. I'm sorry, what was your question?
Oh, just why the
spear, not hook?
And yeah. I think I got the answer. So my next question is, are they not very fast either if they're more susceptible to spearing? Or are they just so large that that makes them a good target?
They're so large, and they're also very curious fish. So people hang decoys down in the water to attract the sturgeon. They're bottom-dwelling fish, so they kind of like to hang out on the bottom of the water. So they put decoys in to attract them. So they're kind of, you know, if you can get their attention, they'll come up and check out your decoy, and then it's much easier to spear them.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, the people around Lake Winnebago, too, they're the ones who basically decided that they wanted to take sturgeon by spearing in Lake Winnebago. So in the 30s, when they reopened sturgeon spearing after after putting a prohibition on any sturgeon fishing throughout the state, the people around Lake Winnebago put a lot of pressure on the legislature and said, we want to reopen sturgeon harvest on Lake Winnebago, and we want to only take them by spearing.
And you mentioned protecting the sturgeon and all the back and forth. It's legal, it's not legal, spears, no spears. What's the current state of efforts to keep sturgeon numbers up and make sure they get old enough to make more sturgeon?
The sturgeon population in Lake Winnebago is extremely healthy. The biologists at the DNR would say that they're probably at an all-time high, and the lake is probably at carrying capacity, so it probably can't really support too many more sturgeon. The sturgeon population in Lake Winnebago has been protected by the state since 1903, so there's been a lot of state effort that's gone into protecting these fish. And then there's been a lot of citizen involvement, too. There's a group called Sturgeon for Tomorrow that formed in the 1970s, made up of a lot of spearers who decided that they wanted to start taking measures to help protect sturgeon, too, so that they would be around for them to spear. So they put on a lot of fundraisers and support sturgeon research. And then they also help support, the DNR runs a sturgeon patrol every spring. So you can volunteer to go up on the Wolf River where much of the spawning activity takes place. And you can volunteer for a 12-hour shift to stand on the riverbank and guard the sturgeon to make sure nobody poaches them.
Do the fishermen and fisherwomen generally eat the sturgeon that they spear?
Yes, they do. I didn't know what a sturgeon would taste like, and I thought, well, maybe, you know, everybody's just looking for a trophy fish, but they're delicious. So yes, they do eat them, and often they'll have a big party. If somebody in the family gets a sturgeon, they'll have a big party and cook up the sturgeon, and it's gone pretty fast.
What do you compare the taste to? If people eat a lot of different fish, are they kind of like what? I don't know.
It's a really rich-tasting fish, I didn't think fishy at all. It's excellent smoked. It's probably the best smoked fish that I've ever tasted.
And what about the spear itself? Where does a person get a spear?
Yeah.
Sounds kind of specialized.
It is specialized. You can't go to just Cabela's and buy a sturgeon spear. They're handmade by people who live around the lake. So we did a section in the book on the art of sturgeon spearing. There are spear makers around the lake. Some go back three or four generations who have been making spears. They're usually about, to go and buy a sturgeon spear from somebody, usually around, I think, $150 to $200, depending on, you know, the quality of the spear.
And is there a competition to produce, to be the best spear maker around the lake?
That I don't know of. People have different, everybody has their own, you know, what's the best decoy, what's the best spear. There are two main types of spears. One is a fixed barb spear, so the tines on the spear, like a pitchfork, and actually a lot of them are made out of pitchforks. The tines have little barbs on them to hold into the fish once you spear it. Some of them have fixed barbs, and some of them have what's called flying barbs. So they would go in flush, and then once they're inside the fish, the little barbs come out so that you don't try and spear the sturgeon and then have the fish get off your spear.
Do people in other parts of the country spear sturgeon, or is it just a Wisconsin thing?
It's basically just a Wisconsin thing. There is another sturgeon spear season in Michigan on Black Lake, but they have such a small sturgeon population that the season is over after 5 sturgeon have been speared. So here in Wisconsin, there are various different caps for different age classes of sturgeon, but well over 1,000 will be speared here in Wisconsin.
And Kathy, are you going to go out on the ice this year either to spear yourself or to watch other people spear sturgeon?
I've never gotten a tag to spear a sturgeon. I have sat out in a shanty with people all morning to watch them wait for a sturgeon. And, you know, I thought it would be, what do you talk about with somebody who you don't really know for that long? But, wow, the time goes by really fast looking in that hole. And I will be heading up there this weekend. I'm going to go up tomorrow night to do a talk, and then I have some coworkers who have never seen the whole sturgeon culture before, so they're going to meet me up there, and we'll spend some time.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us, and stay warm out on the ice.
Okay, thanks a lot.
That's Kathy Klein, educational specialist at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. She's co-author of People of the Sturgeon.
If you have a question about Wisconsin that you'd like us to answer in our Curious Wisconsin segments, you can call and leave us a message at 1-855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. And you can also leave feedback or other segment suggestions there.